Hello, and welcome to The New Threat, Employee Theft and of Trade Secret or Confidential Information in the Name of Protected Whistleblowing. My name is Jacob, and I'll be in the background answering any WebEx technical questions. If you experience technical difficulty at any time during this WebEx event, please submit your technical issue into the Q&A panel, and I will try to assist you. You may also contact WebEx technical support at 1-866-229-3239 for further assistance. Please note that as an attendee, you are part of a larger audience. However, due to privacy rights, we have chosen not to display the number or list of attendees to everyone on the call today. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded. We will be holding a Q&A session at the conclusion of today's presentation as time allows. You may ask an online question anytime throughout the presentation today by simply typing your question into the Q&A panel located on the right-hand side of your screen, or by clicking on the question mark icon located on the floating toolbar in the bottom right side of your screen. Just type your question into the text field and click send. Please keep the send to defaulted to all panelists. With that, we invite you to sit back, relax, and enjoy today's presentation. I would now like to introduce you to one of your presenters for today, Steve Perlman. He is a partner in the Chicago office and co-chair of the National SOX Whistleblower Team. Steve, you now have the floor.
Thanks so much, and thanks everybody for taking time out of your busy schedules to allow us to teach you about a new area of law. We're dealing with a green field right now where the law is very conflicted, where it's unsettled, and we're dealing with new risks. And so we're going to give you some guidance as to what the doctrine is here, and also we're going to hope that you walk away with some real important nuggets in terms of practical guidance so you can know how to manage risk going forward. Let me give you a required disclaimer before I begin. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw LLP for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. The information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The materials discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments in the PowerPoint, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. Questions can be submitted anytime throughout the presentation through the web conferencing tool. If we do not answer them right away, we'll try to address your question after the presentation. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance verification form sent that will be sent via email immediately after today's presentation. Please write the code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Thanks for bearing with me through that. Let me give you an overview of what my partner Robert Milligan and I are going to cover today. First, we're going to talk about recent decisions addressing the interplay between maintaining confidential information that belongs to the company and protecting your trade secrets, which we recognize oftentimes may be a company's most valuable asset, and protected activity. I'll define what that means because it is a nuanced question. There's different forms of protected activity, and there's different subcategories of protected activity. Oppositional activity and participatory activity are two concepts that I want you to understand by the end of the webinar. We'll discuss this in the context of federal litigation, both in discrimination litigation in federal courts and state courts, as well as in whistleblower-specific litigation that we see before the Administrative Review Board of the Department of Labor, as well as federal courts. And we'll look at the ills and the concerns that are related to self-help discovery. That's a very pleasant way of talking about, in my view, theft of confidential company documents. We'll also talk about the whistleblower bounty programs and how it impacts this landscape. What does the new whistleblower bounty provision say in Dodd-Frank with respect to employer enforcement or threatened enforcement of confidentiality agreements? Robert will talk to you specifically about the duty to safeguard trade secrets and confidential information and how that arises under various statutes, as well as appropriate procedures and strategies that you can use to make sure that your most confidential documents remain safeguarded. We'll also talk with you about various methods of addressing anonymous whistleblower in this era of social media and internet communication that oftentimes becomes open to the public quicker than an employer may get wind of it. So let's talk a little bit of blocking and tackling here to get you into the ballpark. What is protected activity? Now, the cases that I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to focus on seven cases here that really tell you what the landscape is, and I think while the doctrine is not well settled, we can glean from these seven marquee cases some overarching principles that should help guide you in taking measures that you can use to minimize risks to your company. Title VII principles with respect to retaliation really transcend the Title VII context and go into other contexts as well. So although these concepts arise in the Title VII context, they'll apply elsewhere as well, as I'll explain in greater detail as we go on. In order to state a claim for retaliation in the Title VII context, Title VII, for those of you who don't practice employment law, is the statute that principally prohibits any sort of retaliation or discrimination based on protected characteristics. And participation versus opposition is what you're going to need to understand in particular. What's participation? Well, you can really intuit what participation is. Filing a charge of discrimination with the EEOC or a local state analog such as the Illinois Department of Human Rights, claiming any sort of discriminatory conduct by the employer or any retaliatory conduct by the employer, as well as giving testimony or assisting in a legal proceeding or otherwise participating in an investigation or some sort of a hearing or any sort of a proceeding under Title VII or civil rights statutes. So that seems fairly intuitive. You're necessarily availing yourself of the legal process there or otherwise assisting in the legal process being carried out. It's just that simple. Participation is given a tremendous amount of deference and respect when we talk about what is protected activity in the retaliation context. And you'll see how this becomes an issue as we go along. By contrast, oppositional activity gets scrutinized more and it's more susceptible to a balancing test. A balancing test is really what the majority of the courts use to determine whether or not employee self-help efforts, and when I refer to self-help, what I'm referring to is an employee really going out on their own and stealing company documents to use for selfish purposes. You know, I represent management with those terms, but really I don't think it's a mischaracterization of the type of issues that you need to be concerned with. So opposition involves informal use of grievance procedures, staging informal protests, voicing opinions to an employer, or otherwise opposing any sort of discriminatory or otherwise unlawful activities. Again, opposition is subject to a balancing test. Now, some courts have subjected participation to a balancing test too, but participation, again, you should know if you're faced with a case where an employee says, I was retaliated against because I engaged in participatory activity, you're going to have a harder time subjecting that sort of activity to a balancing test than you will in an oppositional case. So it's also fundamental that we understand what protected activity is in the Sarbanes-Oxley whistleblower context, because a recent decision came out from the Administrative Review Board, which is the top tribunal at the U.S. Department of Labor. It's the Vinoy versus Celanese decision. And that decision really is what is giving employers a tremendous amount of heartburn right now, because in essence, many employers have viewed that decision as countenancing employee theft of trade secrets in the name of protected whistleblowing activity. And we'll talk about that in greater detail later. But to make sure that you're in the ballpark, I want you to understand what protected activity is in the SOX whistleblower context. protected activity really is an elusive concept when we talk about Sarbanes-Oxley in particular. On the face of the statute, this is Section 806 of Sarbanes-Oxley, we see that it means providing information that an employee reasonably believes to violate, so that reasonably believes means that it doesn't have to actually violate the law, and the employee just has to have a reasonable belief that there's a violation of the law. And the laws at issue are federal fraud laws, such as mail wire, bank, or securities fraud laws, as well as, and you should look at this in the disjunctive, federal law relating to fraud against shareholders, or any rule or regulation of the SEC. Now, you should know if you're dealing with SOX cases that it's become increasingly difficult to challenge whether an employee engaged in protected activity based on a decision that came out on May 25th, 2011. That, incidentally, was the same date that the SEC issued its rules implementing Dodd-Frank's recent whistleblower provisions. So this decision broadly expands the scope of protected activity in the following ways. You should know that an employee need not show that the fraud of which he or she complains has to be fraud on shareholders. Many employers found this very surprising, not only because it conflicted with precedent, but also the purpose of Sarbanes-Oxley was indeed to protect shareholders and make up for the loss of investor confidence after we saw some corporate scandals and the law got enacted in 2002 as a result. There's also an evisceration by this court in Sylvester as to a defense that employers used. We colloquially refer to this as the definitively and specifically defense. And essentially, that's a defense that required employers used to require employees to show that the misconduct of which they complained specifically and definitively related to one of the types of fraud that is noted on the face of Section 806 of Sarbanes-Oxley, the whistleblower provision. Also, the court said that there is no criminal fraud standard, which eliminates the materiality requirement, so the employee could be complaining about a relatively small amount of money. And if an employee is just complaining about a theoretical risk about fraud occurring in the future, this opinion suggests that that could, under some circumstances, qualify as protected activity. With that said, what I want to call your attention to first is the Quinlan decision. This is a very important decision. It came out of the Supreme Court of New Jersey. Now, you may wonder, well, why is a state Supreme Court decision so important if, for example, I'm dealing with a federal court in the Ninth Circuit, for example, or if I'm dealing with a federal court in the Third Circuit? Why am I concerned about Quinlan? The reason is that this area, surprisingly, is relatively green, and the law is unsettled. Quinlan is a broad-sweeping decision. It purports to be as comprehensive as it gets, and the court says that the Sixth Circuit case in Nieswander, which I'll talk about in a moment, was not sufficiently broad, and the court was unsatisfied with the Sixth Circuit decision, which is surprising. And so this decision purports to flesh out, so to speak, some of the standards that are set forth in other decisions that matter. So my point is that although this is a case from the Supreme Court of New Jersey, it's getting cited often, and it merits your attention without question. Let me give you an overview of the facts of this case, because they're very instructive when you understand its import. The plaintiff in this case was the executive director of human resources, female, and she filed a lawsuit under the New Jersey LAD, the law against discrimination there. Now, the reason that I mentioned that this person was an executive director of human resources is because in the ordinary course of her business, she had access to exceedingly sensitive material, including social security numbers, including employee performance evaluations, including other documents that relate to rating employees. So this is a person in a very high-level position who, in my view, has a heightened duty to the company to make sure that certain documents are treated with confidentiality. Now, she signed an acknowledgement of the company's code of conduct, a document that precluded her from broadly from using any company confidential documents for her own purposes. Now, in this case, the employee claimed that she was discriminated against based on her sex when another employee who was male was given a position that was superior to her. The court believed that objectively that employee who was male who got that position had far lesser qualifications for the position than her. So in order to prove her claims, the plaintiff first started gathering a substantial number of documents that were available to her in the ordinary course of her business, and she started giving them over to her attorneys. Now, throughout the litigation, she continued that conduct, but it became particularly troubling when she got her hands on her superior's performance evaluation. And during the deposition of her superior, her attorney sprung that document out in the middle of the deposition. It was a surprise to defense counsel. Ultimately, she was terminated after the deposition. Now, she brought a retaliation claim on this basis, and she ended up winning $10 million after two trials. Case went up on appeal. The New Jersey Appellate Court found that her conduct warranted her termination. This went up then immediately to the New Jersey Supreme Court, and the New Jersey Supreme Court sided with the trial court, reversed the appellate court, and gave some curious reasoning here. Now, let's take a look at the test that the Quinlan court set out. It calls this a balancing test to determine whether or not Quinlan engaged in protected activity. So it's critically important to understand the following seven factors here. The first factor is, how did the employee come into possession of the documents? This, as you'll see as I talk about a couple of other cases as we go on, is extremely important, because if the employee came across the documents innocently, or they came across the documents, they got, for example, an errant email that was sent to them, or somebody left a document out in the open that they saw, in contrast to an employee intentionally snooping around, breaking into employer databases, and otherwise engaged in material that clearly is nefarious, that's something that the court will consider in determining whether or not the employee engaged in protected activity. What did the employee do with the documents is another important factor. If the employee just gave it to her attorney, some courts find that is okay. You know, that keeps it within the realm of protected activity here. Contrast that, however, to a situation where an employee gives the documents to a third party or otherwise disseminates it to the workforce or gives it to the press. In those sorts of situations, a court is less apt to side with the employee in determining whether or not there's protected activity. The third factor is, look at the nature and the content of the documents. What if the document contains the secret formula to a popular soft drink versus a document that's a little bit more innocuous? The document that really will set forth company secrets and competitively important information is going to be subject to greater protection. Also, look at whether or not the disclosure and theft, as I would call it, violated a company policy or violated the company's duty of loyalty or another common law duty to the company. This should tell you right away, take a look at your confidentiality policies right now. Make sure that they're rock solid, make sure that they're very broad, cover all the information they need to, and are widely disseminated, and that employees sign off on them. The fifth factor is whether the disclosure is unduly disruptive to the employer's business. Now, you'll see that this is an awfully important factor here. And in this case, I think that this is something that the court gave very short shrift to, because you're dealing with a very high-level employee, one of the top employees in human resources, who's in a heightened position of trust. And for employees not to have confidence that she's going to treat these documents appropriately, instead just use them for her own purposes, I think could be awfully disruptive to the employer's business. I found it curious that the Quinlan court didn't spend more time focusing on that, if at all. Also, look at the employee's reason for taking the document rather than just describing its existence. Now, what the courts find is that it's obvious. An employee could just write down notes about the document and give it to their attorney, and the attorney could ask for the document in the context of a Rule 34 discovery request pursuant to the rules of federal civil procedure. Now, is this a document that's written on the back of a napkin and an employee thinks that the employer is likely to discard it? Maybe in that situation they may have a better case. But in this case, too, there's no real reason why Ms. Quinlan couldn't have just described the document and then requested it through discovery. That's something that the court overlooked in a curious way. Now, according to the Quinlan court, the very most important factor is to look at the broad remedial purpose of the anti-discrimination law and the effect of disallowing the use. Well, I think that's inherent in all of the decisions that I'll talk about, but it's something that the court says is the most important. So obviously an employee has a right to engage in activity where they're going to protect their civil rights and stave off any sort of retaliation. But on the other hand, the manner in which they do it, you'll see in the preceding factors, still remains of the utmost importance. Now, the court said that it needs to strike a balance, so it's using a balancing test that others have used. On the one hand, it weighs the employer's right to conduct business. On the other hand, it looks at, and in looking at the employer's right to conduct business, they look at an employer's right to make employment decisions and to carry out its business in an orderly way. Weigh that against an employee's right to be free from discrimination or retaliation. So you have, in weighing the employer's rights, obviously a central concern is, you know, doesn't an employer have a right to make sure that its trade secrets and other confidential documents remain confidential? How do you strike that balance? This court says that you look at the flexible totality of the circumstances approach, but the language is awfully amorphous. It then digs down one step a little lower and says, look at what's reasonable under the circumstances. Now, the court's reasoning in this decision is awfully curious, according to the dissent. The dissent says, and rightly so, I believe, that the employer could have terminated the employee for taking the documents. The court says that, well, that's not why the majority says that's not why the employee was terminated. The employee was terminated for her counsel's use of the documents in a deposition. The dissent says this is a distinction that's very difficult to decipher. The bottom line is that the employer terminated the employee for taking the documents that were highly confidential and using them in a self-serving way. Now, let's talk about the Nieswander case. This is a Sixth Circuit case that the Quinlan court analyzed. In this case, the employee, by contrast, lost. The employer prevailed. In this case, the employer terminated the employee because she gave confidential documents to her attorneys in connection with a class action alleging discrimination, and that violated a privacy policy that she had signed. Now, the employer here played up the fact that the documents that she took and gave to her attorneys in a case where she opted in that was brought by another worker, those were irrelevant to the lawsuit. Okay, this was a very principled decision. The court said there's no real purpose that you're bringing this for other than to really jog your memory in connection with some lawsuit that you opted into. That's not enough. That didn't persuade the court. In reaching that conclusion, the court used a balancing test that's very similar to what Quinlan used. They focused on the manner in which the documents were obtained. Were they given to any third parties or just to the plaintiff's attorney? Were the documents themselves sensitive in terms of the substance of the information they created? Are they trade secrets? What was really the purpose of producing the documents here? Again, they really were not responsive to any discovery requests in the class action. How broad was the employer's privacy policy, and could the employee have preserved the documents in a way that doesn't violate the policy? Write some notes about the document, sue, and then propound a discovery request based on the notes that you had already taken. In this case, again, the court found that really these documents were irrelevant to the broader class action that she opted into. And it's a decision that played up a parade of horribles that relates to employee self-help, a good one to rely on. A great one to rely on is the O'Day decision. This is a Ninth Circuit decision. Many expected that the Ninth Circuit, given that its decisions sometimes are quite liberal, would be closer to Quinlan, but that's not the case. It's a lot closer to Nieswander and even stronger than Nieswander. In this case, you had an employee who was rummaging through files in her supervisor's office on the night that she was denied a promotion. These files were kept in the supervisor's drawer. It had notes that were clearly about sensitive personnel matters. In fact, they were prominently marked personal, private, and sensitive. So the employer, not surprisingly, terminated the employee for engaging in this conduct. The Ninth Circuit used a balancing test that's quite similar to what was articulated in the Nieswander case. And ultimately, the court struck the balance in the employee's favor, emphasizing that the employee breached the employer's trust in this surreptitious taking of documents in a way that really compromised the employer's interest in making sure that the documents remain confidential. So the court also articulated its general balancing test too, saying that you weigh the employer's interest in having a harmonious and efficient workplace with the protections of anti-discrimination laws against an employee's right to be free of retaliation and to engage in protected activity. The court said, look, you know, simply wanting to contest an employer's practices that could be discriminatory doesn't give an employee a license to break into confidential files, and giving it to their attorney doesn't create an insurance policy for them. The Eighth Circuit issued a decision in Kempke, which is closer to the Quinlan case, in many respects, diverges from Nieswander and diverges from O'Day. In this case, I think the most important factor here was that the employee had received the document in what the court found to be an innocent way. It was an innocent acquisition. And the court said, look, there was nothing that was disruptive or excessive about the way that the employee engaged in this activity. And moreover, the court took a good close look at whether or not the plaintiff in Kempke gave the document to any third parties. And they contrasted that to the O'Day decision, where they did give it to a third party here. We'll talk about that, because if the employee takes the document and only gives it to their attorney and not anybody else, the Kempke court shows you that at least the Eighth Circuit and some other circuits, you know, in courts like Quinlan, are more apt to find in favor of the employee in terms of whether they engaged in protected activity. Now let's talk about the Watkins decision. Again, I'm going to shift back to a decision favoring the employer. This is a great decision for employers to rely on. The employer took a very hard line, found that the employee really should have known that the documents that they had, based on common sense alone, were private materials that they shouldn't have been snooping around to gather. In this case, the plaintiff claimed that he was discriminated against because he didn't receive a promotion. In the course of discovery, he produced files that contained information regarding sensitive personnel issues such as compensation and the quality of performance. After the employee was terminated on this basis, he added a claim for retaliation. Now, the court found that he did not engage in protected activity, so it rejected his claim. Now, the employee said, look, the documents that I found were in a book that were left open. Anybody could have seen this book. The papers weren't marked confidential. There's no reason that you should impose this heightened standard upon me. The court said, we don't buy that for one second. And the following quote I thought was powerful. It says, were we to adopt plaintiff's argument that the conduct's protected activity, plaintiffs everywhere would be entitled under the umbrella of protected activity to steal company information so long as they gave it to their employer. You know, that's something that I think is intuitive reasoning here. Now, here's something that turns the law on its head in the whistleblower context, and that's the Vannoy decision. Now, the Vannoy decision, and you have to take a deep breath before you read this decision because it's vexing in many respects. It doesn't have a balancing test, and it really is devoid of some necessary guidance for employers. Now, in this case, like in some of the other cases, in particular Quinlan, the employee got a hold of documents and confidential information that he was privy to by virtue simply of doing his job. But he had a sensitive position where he had access to scores of employee confidential information such as social security numbers, as well as other very sensitive confidential proprietary documents that belong to the employer. Now, the company discovered that Mr. Vinoy sent confidential and proprietary information to his personal email account. This was at odds with his agreement to abide by the confidentiality restrictions in a code of conduct related document. And during his employment, he was engaged in whistleblower activity, and that's what's important. His defense was, look, I was gathering all of these materials in order to build a whistleblower case through the IRS whistleblower program. How else am I going to build my case other than by taking documents that I come into contact with in the ordinary course of doing my job? Well, of course, the answer is you could file a lawsuit and you could seek the documents through Rule 34, and then critically, you can both sides can use a protective order that can safeguard the confidential nature of these documents. Court didn't really address that, though. Now, Mr. Vinoy went ahead and filed a whistleblower claim. The case got up to the Administrative Review Board, the top tribunal of the Department of Labor. Now, the Administrative Review Board recognized that there is a significant tension between a confidentiality policy that employers have and provisions in Dodd-Frank, which preclude companies from enforcing or threatening to enforce confidentiality agreements to prevent whistleblowers from cooperating with the SEC. So the Administrative Review Board ultimately said, look, we need an evidentiary hearing below to determine whether the information that was gathered is original information that Congress intended to protect. What is original information? Well, that's fleshed out when you look at Section 21F of the Dodd-Frank Act, the whistleblower protection provisions. And secondly, the court said, in very sweeping terms, is the method of the transfer of the information lawful conduct within the scope of Sarbanes-Oxley? But it didn't explain what that means. Is it unlawful if it violates statutes such as the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act? Is it unlawful if it violates common law doctrine and subjects the company to civil penalties? You know, the court said that there were no charges brought against him, so it seems to suggest that as long as the conduct wasn't criminally unlawful, then the ARB may countenance it. But what was conspicuously absent from this decision is any sort of a balancing test. Every other court has used a balancing test. None of the seven factors in Quinlan or the six factors in Nieswander or the general balancing that you saw in O'Day or in Watkins or in Kempke were applied. So it's a vexing decision. Now, in terms of Dodd-Frank, I've just mentioned above that Dodd-Frank now presents a serious risk to employers because it prevents employers from enforcing or threatening to enforce any sort of confidentiality agreement. Now, like in Vinoy, one area that an employer has to explore here is whether or not the type of information that's being stolen from the employer and submitted to the SEC or to the IRS in the case of Vinoy is original information. Is it independent knowledge? Is it independently acquired? And we've provided on this slide some of the different factors that you would look at to make a determination as to whether or not these materials qualify for protection under Dodd-Frank's whistleblower regime. Let me talk to you lastly about the Tides decision. In the Tides decision, this is a case that was brought first out on the West Coast in federal district court against Boeing, and it went up to the Ninth Circuit, and the employer won in both levels. The plaintiffs in this case worked in the IT SOX audit group. So they're employees who had access, just like Quinlan, and just like the plaintiff in some of the other cases that I've mentioned, such as Vinoy and Nieswander, they had access to very sensitive information. They were very high-level employees. they complained to a newspaper that some of the activities that related to audit in the Boeing activity were untoward in their view, that there were certain controls that weren't being complied, the control requirements weren't being complied with, that there were contractors that were being used to conduct audits. But the Ninth Circuit said, on the plain face of Section 806 of Sarbanes-Oxley, a report out to the press is not protected activity. So if you're dealing with the Sox whistleblower case and your plaintiff claims that they engaged in protected activity by complaining to anybody other than the following, you have a legitimate ground to claim that they did not engage in protected activity. So they can complain to a law enforcement or federal regulatory agency, a member or committee of Congress, a supervisor of the individual who, you know, their supervisor, if the supervisor has the authority to investigate, conduct some discovery into, or otherwise terminate the misconduct. So I hope that this provides you with some overarching principles in determining whether or not an employee has engaged in protected activity. And again, remember that an employee who engages in participatory activity is really going to get more leeway in most cases than an employee who engages in oppositional activity. Now I'm pleased to turn this over to my partner, Robert Milligan, out of our LA office. Robert is a true expert in trade secrets and competition laws. Before we turn it over to Robert and he gives you some practical tips that really help you know what steps to take now that you know what the doctrine is, let me give you the number for your CLE credit. To receive CLE credit for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance verification form sent that will be sent by email immediately after today's presentation. Submit the form to the person indicated on that page. The code is SS2273. SS2273. I'm certainly open for questions following the webinar if you wish to email me any. Thank you so much. Robert, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Steve. I want to cover with the audience three main issues today. First, the duty to safeguard trade secrets and confidential information under SOX and the applicable trade secret statutes. I also want to discuss appropriate procedures and strategies for protecting company trade secrets. And then finally, I wanted to address some tips to address anonymous whistleblowers in the internet and social media age. Now, the first thing we want to cover is the duty to safeguard and how Sarbanes-Oxley comes into play. Now, the central goal of Sarbanes-Oxley is the accurate valuation and protection of a company's assets. Now, company's assets do include trade secrets. And so what does that mean for trade secrets? It means that traditionally trade secrets have been thought as an undefined intellectual property right. But with the passage of Sarbanes-Oxley, there are now mandated duties of disclosures and internal controls that have transformed trade secrets into an asset that must be valued and reported. So board of directors as well as key officers of a company now have obligations under Sarbanes-Oxley as it relates to trade secrets. The key elements of Sarbanes-Oxley that are in play are Section 302, Section 404, and Section 906. Now, under 302, the CEO is required to certify the annual and quarterly reports, making sure that they contain no untrue or misleading statements and that the information reported fairly represents the condition of the company. So that's key with respect to the phrase condition of the company. If they do not have adequate protections in place, they could be arguably in violation of this particular Section 302. Section 404 is probably more apt, and it requires companies to document, test, and certify the scope and accuracy and effectiveness of internal control structures and procedures for financial reporting. And then, of course, if you do not follow these sections, there are significant penalties for violations, both civil and criminal violations. Now, with respect to Section 404, the SEC compliance guidelines identify the safeguarding of assets as one of the internal controls that must be verified. The SEC defines internal control over financial reporting to include procedures regarding the prevention or timely detection of unauthorized acquisition, use, or disposition of the issuer's assets, that could have a material effect on the financial statement. Now, I've highlighted the language prevention or timely detection of unauthorized acquisition, use, or disposition of the issuer's assets, and that includes trade secrets. And it's important to note that even if the company is not subject to Sarbanes-Oxley, companies owe a fiduciary duty to protect their shareholders and to protect the assets of the company. So this advice that we're providing is applicable to companies that are not subject to SOX. So what does this mean as far as a big picture? The implications of SOX impacts. At a minimum, companies should create a trade secret protection committee or a corporate officer whose job it is to identify, value, and protect trade secrets. But before you can do that, the company has to have an understanding of what its trade secret is, where one finds their trade secrets, and how to appropriately protect a trade secret. The key in complying with SOX is to identify, inventory, and value, as well as institute internal controls to protect trade secrets. As a brief overview of what a trade secret is, many states, including 46 states in the United States, have adopted a variation of the Uniform Trade Secret Act. And while the definition may vary by jurisdiction, it typically refers to information that derives an economic value from being not generally known in the industry and is subject to reasonable measures to maintain its confidentiality. And that's key, because you don't have a trade secret if you don't have reasonable measures to maintain its confidentiality. It's baked into the definition of a trade secret. There are some jurisdictions, such as New York and Massachusetts, that have not adopted the Uniform Trade Secret Act, but they still protect trade secrets through the common law. Now, an example of a particular adoption of the Uniform Trade Secret Act is in California, and this is the particular definition of a trade secret. And as you can see, item 2 of the definition of a trade secret is the information subject of efforts that are reasonable under the circumstances to maintain its secrecy. Trade secrets don't have to be novel or unique, and no registration need be filed. In fact, secrecy is the key, so you wouldn't ever file your trade secrets, unlike a patent application. It's not published, and two or more can possess a trade secret, meaning that independent derivation of a trade secret is permitted and an absolute defense to trade secret misappropriation. Examples of trade secret from the previous definition under the California trade secret statute: it can be a formula, a pattern, a compilation, a program, a device, method, technique, or process, customer list, sensitive financial information, source code, and specific knowledge about particular customer information that's protected. And where do you find trade secrets? You find trade secrets throughout a company. They can be on the computer servers, lab notebooks of engineers, computer files, databases. More and more, they're found in cloud computing environments. Salesforce.com, is that's where you're housing your customer information. They can be contained in email, whiteboards, in one's head. Within a company, trade secrets can be found anywhere. Now, I think some of the key takeaways with respect to the duty to safeguard trade secrets, there are 5 main points to cover as far as how to effectuate the duty to safeguard trade secrets. There's 5 main areas that you need to look at. First, you need to have a trade secret protection committee or an officer to own the responsibility for protecting the trade secrets in a particular company. As part of analyzing your protections of trade secrets, you need to look at the physical security, the IT security, agreements and policies and procedures with employees and third parties, and you also need to look at employee relations. Now, some of the greatest threats to trade secrets are insiders, employees, top-level management employees, as well as the foreign threat from foreign countries such as China and India. Now, in looking at one of the 5 items as far as protecting trade secrets, one item to consider is the physical security, and that's the actual facility that the employees work at, and making sure that you have appropriate procedures in place and that access is restricted to particular areas of your facility. So if your research and development department is the lifeblood of the company, you need to make sure that you have particular policies and procedures in place that restrict access. and that information is provided to employees only on a need-to-know basis, and security clearance to particular areas of the company is only provided on a need-to-know basis and a need-to-access basis. Should have a periodic review of access records of employees in high-level areas to making sure that their badging records don't reflect any sort of suspicious activities, sort of late-night entries into the building or early morning entries into the building. And if you do find that there are breaches of your company policy with respect to access, if there's reports of theft, that you need to take action to remedy the security breaches. The third part of analyzing effective procedures for protecting trade secrets is to look at IT security. And information security is key. You need to make sure that the company has password protection for their computer assets and that the company has appropriate email and electronic data policies in place. Often companies use confidentiality reminders on their screens to remind employees of the policies and the access limitations on the use of access. Companies should also consider monitoring of employees' activities with respect to viewing websites as well as emailing company property to personal email accounts. You should also look again, make sure that the company has protections against hacking and phishing so that the internal checks about company data are in place so that you can show that you actually have reasonable secrecy and measures in place to protect your trade secrets. Also, some particular state statutes require encryption of personal identification information, and encryption is expensive, but also always a good way of protecting trade secret material. Employees should be provided regular training on the policies, and one key item in taking care of your trade secrets is to inventory those trade secrets and the particular assets that the trade secrets are stored on, and when employees or vendors and contractors leave, making sure that the devices that the trade secrets are contained on are returned. The fourth part of procedures for protecting trade secrets is to make sure that you have agreements and policies and procedures in place with employees as well as third-party contractors. It's important to have agreements, non-disclosure agreements with employees that include return of materials provisions as well as invention assignment provisions. You should also have agreements, non-disclosure agreements with vendors, independent contractors, and third parties. If you're in the buy, sell, or merger situation, you should make sure that you have due diligence agreements in place. If there's been breaches of these particular agreements, companies should enforce these type of agreements either through informal settlement procedures or through litigation. And the fifth component of making sure you have effective procedures in place for protecting trade secrets is to look at the employee relations. And that includes the onboarding of employees as well as the exit interviews of employees that leave. And it's important that you have effective procedures in place about hiring employees and making sure that in the interview process, trade secret and confidential information is not being disclosed so that the company could be subject to a trade secret theft lawsuit from a competitor. Also, with respect to the hiring process, it's important that when you onboard the new employees that you make sure that they sign non-disclosure agreements and, if applicable in the particular jurisdiction, non-compete agreements, and make sure that you have signed copies of the agreement in the HR file. And a company should really consider if the jurisdiction allows that they have the maximum allowable restrictive covenants that they can with their employees, including non-competes, invention assignment agreements, if the state allows it, prohibitions against solicitation of customers as well as solicitation of employees, as well as the assignment of IP rights if the particular employee is working on inventions for the company. With respect to exit procedures, it's important to make sure that your company does have in place exit procedures. And as part of the exit interview process, it may be a good idea to take a look at the employee's emails for any suspicious activities so that you can confront them during the exit interview process. During the exit interview, you should also present the employee with a copy of their agreement and try to get them to acknowledge that they will, in fact, follow their agreement. That will give you an early sign of whether or not there could be a problem employee and whether or not they may be in possession of trade secrets that they shouldn't. If you have suspicions, you should consider seriously imaging the employee's hard drive to detect whether or not they've taken any trade secrets. Now, with respect to employee relations, because of Sarbanes-Oxley, the interplay between employee relations and the protection of trade secrets spans beyond proper hiring and exit procedures. Now, what happens if, despite all your good intentions and your trade secret protection plan that you've put in place, the current or former employee becomes a whistleblower and steals confidential or trade secret information, claiming it to be evidence of his or her whistleblowing allegations under various statutes, including Sarbanes-Oxley? Now, as Steve mentioned, there are certain bounty provisions in the new Dodd-Frank Act, and under Section 922 of the Dodd-Frank Act, it prevents any person from interfering with a whistleblower's report, including by threatening to enforce confidentiality agreements. Whistleblower thieves may seek revenge by making confidential information public, in addition to bringing it before the SEC. And the new whistleblower rules may decrease incentives to follow internal reporting procedures. So in light of this environment, some of the strategies to protect trade secrets and confidential information when facing a whistleblower thief is to make sure you have clear anti-retaliation policy in place and that you document your investigation of the claim of whistleblowing. And you should follow your corporate compliance program and ethics policies and procedures as it relates to whistleblowers so that the employee can't argue that they're being singled out and treated differently, but rather that the company is following its corporate compliance program and documenting their investigation of the whistleblower activities. It's important to be careful in your communications with the whistleblower. Do not make him or her feel threatened, and you may consider trying to find an employee that the whistleblower thief trusts to get company documents back. You also may consider engaging a third-party neutral to maintain confidential documents and information if the whistleblower has not yet gone to the SEC. You may also consider amnesty negotiations, reminding the whistleblower of the serious legal consequences of stealing trade secrets and confidential information, and you can offer to study the problem internally and report it to the SEC. At the last resort, of course, would be to file a lawsuit against the employee to get the documents and information returned. I think the key is to be prepared with respect to dealing with whistleblower thieves and follow the previously explain steps to increase your likelihood of success against the whistleblower. If you have policies and procedures in place that protect confidential information, then you have greater chance that the whistleblower thief will not necessarily misuse the information. And you'll be armed, especially if you do a quality exit interview, that you have an issue in place and be able to go to court immediately to get your information returned if the employee criminally stole your trade secret information. With respect to the cases that Steve's presented, it's not all bad news. I've collected some cases that show that courts are receptive to act and find against employees who take trade secrets or confidential information. On slide 38 of our presentation, I've listed some of these cases, and I think that there was one good case that I think was worth providing you with the language from that case to show that some courts don't necessarily take the untenable position that the Vannoy case has taken. And that particular case is the JDS Uniphase Corp case, a Eastern District of Virginia case. In that particular case, the court found that by no means can the policy fairly be said to authorize a disgruntled employee to pilfer a wheelbarrow full of an employee's proprietary documents in violation of their contract, merely because it might help them blow the whistle on employers' violations of law, real or imagined. Endorsing such theft or conversion would effectively invalidate most confidentiality agreements, as employees would feel free to haul away proprietary documents, computers, or hard drives in contravention of their confidentiality agreements, knowing they could later argue they needed the documents to pursue suits against employers under a variety of statutes protecting employees from retaliation for publicly reporting wrongdoing. Notably, this was a Sarbanes-Oxley case, so it's in stark contrast to the Vannoy decision. The court went on to say, indeed, were courts to adopt the employee's argument, litigation would blossom like weeds in the spring. For every legitimate whistleblower aided by this rule, many more disgruntled employees would help themselves to company files, computer disks, or hard drives on their way out the door to use for litigation, leverage, or mere spite. So it's refreshing to see that there at least one court has a voice of reason in this this current dispute regarding whether employees can take documents to support their whistleblower claims. I think some of the key takeaways from these cases, also in light of Steve's earlier discussion regarding some of the key factors, that employers must keep close watch on their trade secrets and clearly mark and limit the disclosure of trade secrets. That will help you in a whistleblower case, because you'll be able to show that you had clear policies that the employee violated. You need to have clear handbooks and policies that unauthorized use, access, and dissemination of confidential information will result in discipline, including termination. And it's important that you enforce your policies and procedures and don't wait. The whistleblower will know if in the past you haven't enforced policies and may use that against you. So it's important, whether it's some sort of discipline or termination, that you don't let violations of the policies go by without anything being said. And it's also important to have clear document retention policies and corporate compliance policies. One of the factors that Steve focused on was the employee's belief that the information would be destroyed or deleted by the employer, and so thus they needed to engage in self-help to take the documents. But if you have clear document retentions and policies in place, as well as protections against retaliation against whistleblowers, the court's not going to be concerned that that's an issue that's in play. And then finally, our last topic about procedures protecting trade secrets and the threat of anonymous whistleblowers. What happens if the whistleblower thief is also anonymous? In this age of social media, how does a company deal with sites like WikiLeaks or anonymous bloggers who post trade secret information? And the real response is that it's a total quagmire and mess. It's not an easy process. It can be very expensive, and it can be very difficult to get your information taken down from the Internet. Some important initial considerations. Whistleblowers of this type are often more motivated by a desire for public vindication than by a desire to involve themselves in Sarbanes-Oxley litigation. But that can be a little comfort to a company who's now had their trade secrets and confidential information posted on the Internet. Documents posted anonymously online whistleblower sites are rarely admissible in court without authentication, which would destroy the whistleblower's anonymity. That also could be of little comfort because the information has now been out in the public. But on the plus side, the government may be hesitant to use documents that were illegally taken against the corporation. Other drawbacks are that once the information is placed on the Internet, there are some court decisions that find that the information is no longer a trade secret. Other courts have been more forgiving with respect to that showing. There's a California Supreme Court case, the DVD case, in which the court indicated that just because it was posted on the Internet, it didn't lose its trade secret status. There's also First Amendment concerns with respect to anonymous bloggers posting information on the Internet, and it can be a real problem if the press becomes involved, and they argue that taking the information down is a prior restraint. The information can also be hard to take down if the information involves some issue of public concern or public safety. Another practical reality is once the information is posted on the Internet, there are mirror websites that will disseminate the information rapidly. So even if you can get it taken down by one ISP provider, it may already be out there and go like wildfire. So some of the steps to remedy the situation is to act immediately, to identify the material and to send a demand letter to the ISP provider or the offending party, asking the provider or offending party to remove the content. Now, a lot of the ISP providers won't necessarily respond, but if you're dealing with federal crimes or if you're dealing with federal intellectual property rights, they may be willing to take it down. There are certain safe harbors that the Internet service providers can rely upon to not take the information down, such as if the information revolves around defamatory conduct or First Amendment concerns. Some of the safe harbors include the Stored Communication Act, which prohibits the Internet service provider from voluntarily disclosing information about customers, subject to certain exceptions. There's also First Amendment concerns, as I indicated. The First Amendment gives political speech the highest level of protection, but commercial speech is protected only if the communication is neither misleading nor related to unlawful activity. Now, there are certain elements that work in favor of a business attempting to identify anonymous blogger, which what typically occurs is you file a John Doe lawsuit either in state or federal court. And if you're in federal court, what you do is you'll need to then bring a motion to the court allowing you to do early discovery and serve a subpoena on the Internet service provider so that you can attain the identity of the anonymous blogger. And it's not as simple as just issuing a subpoena. You actually have to get the court's permission before you can issue the subpoena in federal court, and there's a rigorous showing that needs to be made before the court will authorize you to issue the subpoena. And in some instances, summary judgment type evidence is required to be shown to the court before they'll permit you to go forward with the subpoena and obtain the identity of the anonymous blogger. Your case is much better if you can make a prima facie showing of your claim against the anonymous speaker. The anonymous blogger is the defendant in the lawsuit, and the nature of the claim and the interest being protected is not political speech, but unlawful commercial speech, such as posting your trade secret information or posting copyright or trademark material or other indications that that the employee has violated some federal criminal law. The courts are also looking for the identity of the anonymous blogger, cannot be ascertained by other less intrusive means, and effort has been made to give the blogger the notice of the subpoena in advance, either directly or through the ISP. If you can show that those steps have gone forward, the court's more likely to grant your application and allow you to obtain the identity of the anonymous blogger. Some of the things that work against the business trying to identify an anonymous blogger is if the suit involves political speech, the blogger is protected by state shield laws. State shield laws apply to journalists, and that they're trying to make out a claim that they're actually a journalist as opposed to some rogue employee, then they may have a better chance of shielding ascertaining their identity. As I indicated, some courts require summary judgment type evidence supporting your claims, and if the company doesn't have that type of evidence at this point, it could be difficult to get the subpoena request granted. And also, the subpoena is overbroad and is not limited to identifying the anonymous blogger, because you'll have a very difficult time actually obtaining the content. Say if it's an email account and you want to subpoena the emails that are actually in the account, you'll stand a very hard chance of actually obtaining the content, but what you can obtain is the identity of the anonymous blogger. And then the other factor that goes against obtaining the identity of the blogger is that the subpoena seeks information that is cumulative of other evidence in the case. So at this point, I think I'll turn it back over to Steve, and we'll see if we have any questions that we can field. I know we're running a little bit late on time, but we'll try to field some questions. Steve?
Yeah, thanks, Robert. I think that was extremely informative. It's nice to be able to have some solutions at our fingertips when we see that there's so many decisions that are coming out that really are quite daunting to employers. Megan, have you located any questions for us here?
There was one. Here we go, from Rebecca.
Robert, I think this one might fall in your bailiwick. Rebecca asks, why would we want to have a trade secret committee? What is the risk if we don't?
I think the advantages of having a trade secret committee is that if you are a Sarbanes-Oxley reporting company, you need to make sure you have some internal checks that you're protecting your assets, and whether it's the nomenclature is a trade secret committee or whether it's some sort of intellectual property or privacy officer, the goal is to making sure that you have that you've identified what your trade secrets are, that you've inventoried what your trade secrets are, and that you've made sure that you've had adequate protections in place to protect those trade secrets. So you need to do that to comply with SOX, and it's also very valuable. It's also very important because if you want to have a trade secret, you need to show that you have reasonable secrecy measures. So it also will help you get organized with respect to making sure you have adequate trade secret protections in place. And the risk if you don't have a trade secret committee is that whatever you call it, if your company is not doing a good job of identifying the trade secrets and protecting the trade secrets, you could have accountability and responsibility under SOX, And you could also if you want to be a plaintiff in a trade secret suit, you may not have stand a good chance of prevailing because you don't have reasonable secrecy measures in place. And then also, if you're a defendant in a trade secret suit, if you don't have good internal policies in place and you're hiring people who are taking trade secrets and getting your company sued, you can have substantial liability to your company for that trade secret theft.
Thanks, Robert. One other question that we received here is, how else can an employer leverage an employee's misconduct in the context of ongoing litigation? And that's something that I'd like to speak to. Many times, not just once or twice, but on many occasions, I've seen cases where employees bring a lawsuit alleging discrimination or retaliation, and the employer learns during the course of discovery that the employee had resorted to self-help or otherwise misappropriated confidential information. I think you should give serious thought to an after-acquired evidence affirmative defense in this context. I've seen this work on a number of occasions in federal courts. I've seen courts apply the after-acquired evidence doctrine in this context to bar many forms of damages, including limiting back pay and barring front pay and preventing reinstatement in some instances. So the after-acquired evidence doctrine is something you should look into. Essentially, you'd argue that we learned during the course of discovery that an employee engaged in misconduct. Had we known of this at the time that they were employed, we would have terminated the employee on the spot for that reason. I think that wraps up our questions. Want to thank everybody else. Actually, you know what? We just got another question in here, too. Okay. Yeah, Robert, these are within your bailiwick as well. How do you go about identifying the company's trade secrets for large companies with international operations? What if you don't identify all of your trade secrets? Can you categorize them rather than identify them specifically? Do you have any thoughts on that, Robert? Robert, are you able to get this connection?
Yes. With respect to a large company, with respect to identifying your trade secrets, that's why it's so important to have in place a structure and an organization and someone who owns the responsibility. Now, whether that's a committee or that's an individual person, you either put it under, you know, the trade secret, the person that's responsible for trade secrets, or if that's the privacy officer, or if there's some other person that's in the company that's responsible for that. And so you do need to have somebody in charge. It can be a monumental undertaking trying to identify every piece of trade secret. So categories do work. And what typically we've done with trade secret audits is that we'll get, to the extent that we can, a representative from the various entities within the company, whether that's the R&D, whether that's HR, legal, sales, and we'll have a discussion about within those particular groups about what are the most important pieces of information that group deals with, and start using that as the list of the categorizations that you can use in identifying what your trade secrets are. But I think the takeaway is have somebody that's in charge, that's responsible for it, and the organization, having the organization and the procedures in place is essential. And think about having groups from each of the identified groups within the company to have representatives on the committee so that you can help identify what the trade secrets are. And a lot of this has already been done within companies, and it's just a matter of making sure that it's been current and that you actually identify what you already know, and putting pen to paper.
Thanks, Robert. Appreciate it. It looks like our time is up here. Thank you, everybody, for participating. If you have further questions, let us know, and we'll be happy to get back to you. Email, I think, is probably the first best step. Thank you so much.